This is a Rabble Podcast Network show. New voices in your head. It's Radio Free Radio.
You're listening to Red Eye on Vancouver Cooperative Radio, CFRO 100.5 FM.
When Margaret Thatcher was asked what she considered to be her greatest accomplishment, her reply was Tony Blair and New Labour. The rightward shift of liberal and social democratic parties is not just the work of Thatcher and Ronald Reagan. It's the result of decades of effort by a network of right-wing think tanks determined to change the assumptions under which governments operate. Earlier this week, SFU's Institute for the Humanities hosted a talk by Donald Gutstein based on his book, Harperism, How Stephen Harper and His Think Tank Colleagues Transformed Canada. Donald Gutstein is an adjunct professor at the School of Communications at Simon Fraser University, and we'll now listen to excerpts of his talk, which was presented at the SFU Harper Center this past week.
Thank you all for coming tonight to hear about Harperism, how Stephen Harper and his think tank colleagues have transformed Canada. What I'm going to argue that we are indeed witnessing the political transformation of Canada. You must admit that the Canada of today is governed by different values, frames, and ideas than it was as recently as the 1980s. So I'm going to tell you why and how I think this happened. My book, Harperism, discusses in equal measure what Stephen Harper has done as Prime Minister, but and also the ideas that underlie and frame his actions. If you understand those ideas, then what he does makes more sense. Many people have asked me what they need to do to get rid of Harper. My response is, well, you may get rid of him, and that will certainly ease the pain. But the ideas will still be there to guide and constrain whoever follows him. So yes, discuss how to remove Harper from office, but don't forget to have the more important discussion of how to change the ideas that today rule politics. That politics is governed by ideas was most lucidly expressed by British economist John Maynard Keynes in his 1935 classic, The General Theory of Employment, Interest, and Money. And this is what he wrote. The ideas of economists and political philosophers, both when they are right and when they are wrong, are more powerful than is commonly understood. Indeed, the world is ruled by little else. Practical men who believe themselves to be quite exempt from any intellectual influence are usually the slaves of some defunct economist. Madmen in authority who hear voices in the air are distilling their frenzy from some academic scribbler of a few years back. And then he concludes with this, I am sure that the power of vested interests is vastly exaggerated compared with the gradual encroachment of ideas. So when some on the left make the claim that Harper is in thrall to the oil and gas industry, for example, what Keynes would call the power of vested interests, I disagree. Instead, I see Harper following the ideas of several defunct economists, in particular, Austrian economist Friedrich Hayek, who was Keynes' great rival, but agreed with him on the importance of ideas in governing society. In fact, Hayek made it one of his great missions in life to challenge Keynes and promote ideas developed by himself and his classical liberal colleagues he brought together in 1947 that today we call neoliberalism. So it has a long history to it. The quest for a market state, a state governed by market transactions and not through our elected representatives. And I think that's a fundamental notion there. These ideas reached Canada's shores in the 1970s with the creation of the Fraser Institute. They were operationalized first here in British Columbia in 1983 after Bill Bennett's victory and what was called the New Reality. Federally, they appeared under Brian Mulroney the following year. So neoliberal ideas have been around for a long time when Stephen Harper finally took over the reins of government. He has simply been more effective and single-minded in their pursuit than his predecessors. Most of my book is taken up with Harper's neoliberal agenda and his focus on the economy. A second academic scribbler, to quote Keynes again, has also influenced political ideas, particularly in the United States and Canada. German-Jewish philosopher Leo Strauss taught at the University of Chicago for several decades and built a large following in government and academia that is today known as neoconservatism. Simplified, this is the view that most people are too ill-informed to make good political decisions, and a ruling elite must make them instead. As the book explains, these folk have decided that the way to maintain a strong society is through traditional values, religion, and perpetual war. Harper wants the election to be about the economy and security, which is just another way of saying his neoliberal and his neoconservative precedents. So I'll first talk about neoliberalism and how it came to be the dominant ideology. Then I'll mention the neoconservative aspect to the Harper era and end with a discussion of some of the political transformations that we are witnessing. First, what is neoliberalism? Well, there are thousands of books, articles, and blog posts written on the subject, but in my view, it can be reduced to a simple proposition that economic freedom is more fundamental than political freedom, or the market trumps democracy. Neoliberalism as an ideology and an economic philosophy differs sharply from the classical liberalism that stretched back to Adam Smith in the 18th century. That earlier liberalism maintained that government's role in the economy should be strictly limited. The new liberalism, in contrast, promotes a market state in which economic freedom, property rights, free trade, and individual liberty rule politics. Such a society cannot come about without concerted political effort and organization. The role of government in neoliberalism is to create and enforce markets and prop them up when they fail, as is what happened in 2007 and 2008, after the financial meltdown. As geographer David Harvey has explained, if markets do not exist in areas such as land, water, education, healthcare, social security, or environmental pollution, then they must be created by state action if necessary. It's fair to say that neoliberals believe in government, but they have little faith in democracy. In fact, political freedom may not even be necessary. Their ideal state is Hong Kong, especially before it brought in a minimum wage and competition laws. I should note that liberalism, as we commonly use it in North America, is the opposite of the classical liberalism that I was talking about earlier that is still used in Europe. To understand how neoliberalism became the dominant ideology, we need to go back to the end of the Second World War. The war itself was a time of intense government planning and massive industrial effort directed by government. Before the war, Franklin Delano Roosevelt's New Deal made government an essential player in the economy. And after the war came an era of great social progress throughout the developed Western world. Social democracy and the welfare state were the order of the day, driven by values of social justice and collective action. It was also a time when the Keynesian orthodoxy dominated the intellectual landscape. Developing his theory during the Depression, Keynes observed that direct government intervention is required to achieve full employment and assure a sufficient level of demand in the economy. In the world under Keynes, the state held a central role in nation building, modifying the excesses of capitalism and generating some measure of equality of opportunity. Such a vision was the opposite of economic freedom. How could there be such freedom if government was prodding the economy in what it considered to be the right direction? Following the Keynes approach, Wood, Hayek argued in his classic manifesto, The Road to Serfdom, it would lead to a nightmare world of collectivism and socialism, to slavery, not freedom. Shortly after the war, Hayek invited leading European and American intellectuals of various free market persuasions Malaysians, to meet in Mont Pelerin, a Swiss lakeside spa. He charged them to develop theories and strategies to counter the Keynesian orthodoxy and take down central planning as a fundamental activity of government. At that time, Hayek and his free market colleagues were a beleaguered minority, outgunned by Keynesian socialists and Marxists. During their 10 days of talks, they agreed to form the Mont Pelerin Society with a mandate to work towards a market state. It worked better than they could have imagined. 60 years later, social democracy is a fading memory. As Marxist scholar Perry Anderson ruefully observed, whatever limitations persist in its practice, neoliberalism as a set of principles rules undivided across the globe, the most successful ideology in world history. So the Mont Pelerin Society develops the dogma or ideology. Wealthy businessmen set up think tanks to promote that dogma and ideology through research. The think tanks influence secondhand dealers and ideas, and that's a key concept that I will come to in a minute. So the role of the think tanks is to influence secondhand dealers in ideas, which we would know better as, let's say, the media. Okay? The secondhand dealers report the research and gradually alter the political climate. And finally, neoliberal politicians capture and reorganize political power. So it's a simplification of the process, but looking at how it's worked so successfully over that period, I think that's an accurate reflection. In post-war Europe and North America, Hayek and his colleagues realized that political power could not be captured and reorganized by entering politics directly. So the first step was to alter the political climate and make their ideas more acceptable, even welcome. But how to alter the intellectual climate? Hayek had an idea that he outlined in an influential 1949 article, and this is an important article in understanding the history of neoliberalism, called The Intellectuals and Socialism. The key was to influence what he called the secondhand, professional secondhand dealers in ideas, who control the distribution of expert knowledge to the public. And he said these are journalists, teachers, ministers, lecturers, publicists, radio commentators, writers of fiction, cartoonists, and artists. It's quite a broad, sweeping vision. They may be masters of the technique of conveying ideas through their writing or painting or whatever, but they are usually amateurs so far as the substance of what they convey is concerned. So they're professionals at conveying ideas, they're amateurs about the content of the ideas themselves. Nonetheless, they are the people who more than any others decide what views and opinions are to reach us, which facts are important enough to be told to us, and in what form and from what angle they are to be presented. And I think saying those words and thinking of the role of daily newspapers, I think you can see how that could work. So that was a brilliant scheme that Hayek came up with, influencing the secondhand dealers and ideas. If you can get them on board, then you have a much easier time of change of persuading the public of the validity of your ideas. It was a brilliant scheme, but Hayek didn't invent it himself. He copied it from the British Fabian Society, which had been so successful in influencing British governments to introduce some of the first social programs in the pre-World War era, and went on to have great influence in British politics for the next four decades, and the formation of the Labour Party taking over government in after the Second World War. I mention this because if one wants to move away from neoliberalism, a way to do this is to study neoliberal success and then copy it. As to how to influence these secondhand dealers and ideas, Hayek turned once again to the Fabian Society as one of the first think tanks. And he encouraged British businessman Anthony Fisher to, instead of going into politics to fight the socialists, to set up a think tank, which he did in 1956, called the Institute of Economic Affairs. And that, I'll just call it IEA from now on, because I'll be mentioning it. It is a prototype, the model for over 400 neoliberal think tanks that now span the world. And here's how it works. Well, it's led by an intellectual entrepreneur. We think of the Fraser Institute, and we would think of Michael Walker, who is the original founder of the think tank. It's funded by wealthy conservative businessmen and their foundations. And so it must have charitable status so that it can receive funding from the foundations. It supports neoliberal doctrine through evidence presented as research. So the idea here is the Montpelier Society has concluded that trade unions play a harmful role in the labor market and should be eliminated. And Milton Friedman has written extensively on that. Get rid of trade unions. So it's up to the Fraser Institute now to produce research to show how harmful trade unions are to the economy. And they've done that. They do it over and over again. Of course, such research does not stand up to very critical analysis. And we see more and more frequently how people are calling out Fraser Institute research for its failings. It recruits sympathetic academics and hires in-house staff to write these papers. It packages the research into books, reports, studies, teaching materials, and news stories, which it distributes to news organizations and other secondhand dealers. It repeats the research over and over and over again, and gradually new ideas become embedded in public discourse. It's a different kind of research than we would normally attach to a university setting. Well, recent historical studies of neoliberalism identify the direct link between the Montpelier Society, the IEA, and Margaret Thatcher's decisive 1979 election victory and the rise of Thatcherism in Britain. When Thatcher came to power, she wrote to Ralph Harris, the IEA's director, and this is what she said. It was primarily your foundation work which enabled us to rebuild the philosophy upon which our party succeeded in the past. The debt we owe you is immense, and I am very grateful. With best wishes, Margaret. The studies also identify links from the Montpelier Society to the IEA to the Heritage Foundation in the U.S. and the rise of Ronald Reagan about a decade later. And there's also a link to Canada with the Fraser Institute. Anthony Fisher, the businessman who had set up the IEA in the 50s, was invited to Vancouver to help local businessmen set up the Fraser Institute. It took a decade before neoliberal ideas began to influence provincial and federal government policymaking. As I mentioned, the Bill Bennett government took its neoliberal turn after the 1983 election. Fraser Institute Executive Director Walker met with the Bill Bennett cabinet at least six times before that budget came out, and on one occasion he brought Milton Friedman with him to meet the cabinet. Walker and Friedman were the inspiration for the 1983 budget and its accompanying bills that provoked the formation of Operation Solidarity. The following year, the progressive conservative Mulroney government adopted neoliberalism as its guiding light, throwing open the country to foreign investment, eliminating the National Energy Program, transforming the Foreign Investment Review Agency into Investment Canada, bringing in the Canada-US Free Trade Agreement, and signing NAFTA. With their investor rights clauses, these deals raised corporations to parity with government. Neoliberalism became entrenched under the liberal governments of Jean Chrétien and Paul Martin, who accepted the ideology as their own policy orientation. As Chrétien signed NAFTA, and Chrétien and Martin brought in an era of privatization and fiscal restraint. By the time Harper took over government, neoliberalism had been established and normalized as a way of running government. That was his starting point. Harper was certainly sympathetic to neoliberalism and the economic freedom agenda. He was introduced to Hayek as a student at the University of Calgary, where he read Hayek with political scientist Tom Flanagan, considered the founder of the Calgary School, and also known for other reasons too. Hayek's work became the foundation of Harper's graduate thesis, and it continued to influence his thinking as he rose from graduate student to the pinnacle of political power. Once prime minister, minister, Harper made economic freedom a centerpiece of public policy. So we go back to Anthony Fisher again. After he set up the Fraser Institute, he went to Australia to help with the Center for Independent Studies. He came back to the U.S. to do the Manhattan Institute and the Pacific Research Institute. And then requests were coming in thick and fast for people, business people in all over the world to help them set up these institutes, which obviously were being very effective. He set up the Atlas Economic Research Foundation, which was an effort to automate the process of setting up these institutes. And it provided funding and research and expertise and connections to help get these think tanks up and going. It now is a network of over 400 of them. And the interesting thing is the Atlas is, that word comes, of course, from Ayn Rand's Atlas Shrugged. Once Atlas was set up, the first push was into Central and Latin America in the 1980s, and you can see neoliberal think tanks all over Central and Latin America. In the 90s, after the fall of the Berlin Wall, they penetrated Eastern Europe to a large extent, and then have moved into Africa, Southeast Asia, and Asia. And also in the 90s, they started setting up think tanks in every state in the U.S. and in most Canadian provinces so that they could have impact not just on federal policy, but on state or provincial, even municipal policy. So it's totally comprehensive how this works. Today, they are everywhere with over 400 think tanks in the Atlas network, with six in Canada, where they spend upward of $26 million a year to promote economic freedom and other neoliberal goals. Harper was also sympathetic to the neoconservatism and its emphasis on traditional values, religion, perpetual war, and fear as a means to keep a society strong. He was probably also introduced to these ideas at the University of Calgary, where we have Leo Strauss, who taught at the University of Chicago, and two of his students, Alan Bloom and Walter Burns, actually taught at the University of Toronto in the 1970s. And two of their students were Ted Morton and Reiner Knopf, who went from there to the University of Calgary, where they became part of the Calgary School, and also worked with Harper and Preston Manning to establish the ideology, the policy, and the structure of the Reform Party. So Harper was certainly introduced to those ideas at the time. And Ian Brody was a student of Ted Morton, who and followed on the tradition started by Walter Burns, which is really a tradition attacking the Charter of Rights and Freedoms as being antithetical to what the founding fathers of the nation wanted. That's a much stronger tradition in the U.S., but also in Canada. Morton and Knopf have argued that what was in the Confederation Act, the Dominion Act of 1867, is what we should go by, not by add-ons like the Charter of Rights and Freedoms. And so Ian Brody, who also followed in that tradition, became Harper's first chief of staff. So you can see how tightly tied he was to that. In the U.S., some of Strauss's students and followers grabbed control of foreign policy making in the George W. Bush administration and persuaded Americans they needed to invade Iraq, fabricating the evidence for the weapons of mass destruction. Sometimes the people had to be lied to, deceived, to get them to do the things the ruling elite had decided they needed to do. Harper was then leader of the official opposition and rose daily in Parliament to provoke outrage over the illusory weapons of mass destruction and persuade the Chrétien government unsuccessfully to join the coalition of the willing. Once in office, Harper moved forward on neoconservative tenets, making war the default government position, embracing Israel as Canada's closest ally and friend, creating enemies that could never be defeated, and instilling fear as a fundamental Canadian value. There's more to be said about Harper's neoconservatism, but I'll save that for the last section of my talk, which is going to be five significant ways in which Canadian politics are being transformed. I want to start this discussion with a reminder that many of these changes began long before Stephen Harper came to office. Because he has been so single-minded and devoted to this pursuit, it may seem they are totally his doing. So the first transformation, I think, is cutting government's ability to support traditional social programs and services by starving government of the revenues it needs. If these programs programs and services are valuable to people, neoliberals would say they can be provided by the voluntary or for-profit sectors. Harper has cut $45 billion a year from government revenues and at the same time established the frame that with such a fragile economy, balanced budgets are the only responsible course of action. The New Democrats have fallen in line, and the Liberals say they will stray only marginally from the consensus. No party is prepared to raise taxes by very much. The consequence is that with government revenues at the lowest level they've been since the time that Medicare was introduced in Canada, government will no longer be able to provide many of the services Canadians have received for nearly five decades. The second transformation is related to the first, cutting government's ability to collect evidence-based, accurate, and relevant information that government needs to plan for a wide range of services like housing, transportation, environmental protection, and social programs. Here I would include the elimination of the long-form census, closing scientific research stations, shuttering scientific libraries, and while Harper is weakening public oversight and scientific monitoring, his government is moving in the direction of market-based environmentalism. More broadly, Harper is systematically downgrading science, something that actually started under Brian Mulroney, be it environmental science, sociology, or criminology, and replacing them with market signals. After all, as Hayek said, government can never amass and digest the vast amount of information that markets are transmitting every day. Neoliberals fear that scientists will use their knowledge to control government policy when this should be left to the market. With the consensus on balanced budgets and few tax increases allowed, no party will be able to rebuild Canada's scientific capacity. The market may win by default. Third, removing various impediments and obstacles to a market-driven society. Here we could include deregulation of energy projects, intimidation of environmental NGOs. I would argue that both neoliberals and neoconservatives see the Charter of Rights and Freedoms as an entrenched obstacle to the furtherance of their goals. For neoliberals, an obstacle to the market, and for neoconservatives, an obstacle to the furtherance of traditional social values. Efforts to remove organized labor from a role in the labor market, at least at the federal level, with right-to-work policies lurking in the background. The neoliberal view is that employment contracts should be negotiated between individual workers and powerful employers, and we know how that usually turns out. I would also include here Harper's other efforts to undermine collective organization in the economy, such as the Canadian Wheat Board, the privatization of it, and his move to eliminate Canada's system of supply management, something he will most certainly do if he is reelected. Fourth is Harper's tough-on-crime agenda, a neoliberal staple and also something valued by social conservatives. I go back to Gary Becker's 1968 paper, Crime and Punishment, an Economic Approach, as one of the most cited papers in academic history. Becker was a University of Chicago economist who went on to serve as president of the Mont Pelerin Society. He treats crime and punishment as an economic calculation in which criminal acts generate benefits such as material gain or revenge and are subject to costs imposed by the state. If the benefits outweigh the cost, the person commits the crime, as Becker would say. Governments can increase costs by raising the probability of apprehension, such as hiring more police, or increase the severity of punishment. Harper has followed both paths, while the NDP's Tom Mulcair has said he's on board for at least the first part of increasing chances of apprehension by hiring more police officers. It seems that a harsher and more punitive system is lowering its shroud over Canada. What happened to prevention and treatment? And fifth and finally is making perpetual war the default position. From the new citizenship guide, I don't know if any of you have studied that, with its 55 mentions of war in the guide that anybody who's becoming a Canadian citizen has to kind of memorize. to Harper's Afghanistan adventure, his Middle East bombing sorties, and his teaming up with Israel. There are many reasons why he teamed up with Israel, but one is, with Israel as an ally, there are always going to be dangerous enemies to face down. He brought perpetual war and the threat of Islamic terror into the country itself with Bill C-51, which, even if repealed, has subtly shifted the focus of how we view our country and ourselves. There are many others, but let's leave it with those five. Neoliberal success can be measured by the extent to which it has changed our common sense perception and understanding of how the world works. Followers of nearly every political persuasion must pay attention to this reality in their calculations. The experience of other countries, the UK, Australia, the United States, demonstrates the difficulties liberal, used in the North American sense, and social democratic parties have had in moving away from neoliberalism after a period of neoliberal rule. In the US, Bill Clinton ended welfare as we know it after Ronald Reagan had targeted fabricated welfare queens as a blight on society that had to be removed. To a large extent, Obama is following in this tradition. In Britain, Tony Blair transformed the Labour Party into a more neoliberalist rendition to give him a better chance of winning elections. But when asked what her greatest achievement was, Margaret Thatcher replied, "Tony Blair's New Labour," because it meant that her reforms would live on after her. In Canada, we won't know how entrenched Harperism has become for quite a while. But looking back to what Keynes said about the gradual encroachment of ideas, I venture to say it's going to take a time before those ideas can change. When Keynesianism ran into trouble in the 1970s, Milton Friedman was right on the scene with monetarism, and his Montpelier and Society colleagues came forward with privatization, deregulation, and a whole host of reforms to get government out of the way of the market. And that became the prevailing reality over the next four decades. But in 2007 and 8, with the financial meltdown and neoliberalism really crashed, no coherent set of alternatives was available to be put forward. So after a brief return to 1960s-style stimulus spending, it was back to business as usual. As a result, Harper could continue emphasizing the market and the economy over all other values. So neoliberalism will not be replaced as a prevailing ideology until someone like Hayek and some organization like the Mont Pelerin Society have spent the time to construct an alternative set of ideas and made them familiar to secondhand dealers. Then when the next market failure occurs, they will be ready. However, we live today, okay, and we cannot wait until those events might occur. So what I'm sure will come up in the discussion is what are the things we can do today to move away from neoliberalism? And one of the things for sure is for progressives or liberals or social democrats, however you want to define yourself, to speak your values. Right? What is it we believe? What is it we believe about social justice, collective action, and all those kinds of things? Because too frequently now, those parties have convinced themselves that they have to put the economy first. So when I first look at the NDP site for its childcare policy, what it said was Tom Mulcair knows how valuable childcare is to the economy, and for every $2, for every dollar we spent on childcare, the economy will grow by $2. Now they've gone on to change that and put other values, more social values, ahead of that. But it's an example of fearing that all we can do is speak to the consensus, and that way things will never change. And so I just want to end with something that French poet Victor Hugo once famously said: "There is nothing more powerful than an idea whose time has come." Well, actually, Hugo was wrong. What he should have said, and what our study of neoliberalism leads us to conclude, is that when the time comes, make sure you have the ideas. Thank you.
That was Donald Gutstein talking recently about his book, Harperism, How Stephen Harper and His Think Tank Colleagues Have Transformed Canada. Donald Gutstein is an adjunct professor in the School of Communications at Simon Fraser University. This talk was recorded on September 21st at SFU's downtown campus at Harbor Center as part of a lecture series hosted by SFU's Institute of the Humanities. And for more information about upcoming talks in the series, please go to sfu.ca/humanities institute.